Hello and welcome to the Charity Digital Podcast. Today we will be talking about the service delivery landscape for charities in 2025. Charities are mission-led organisations with service delivery at their core. In 2025, around 170,000 charities help to uphold society in the UK with vastly ranging activities, from healthcare to advocacy, from caring for animals to community and cultural activities, from environmental protection to religious events. And that doesn't even cover all of the many services charities can deliver. So service delivery is a broad topic of discussion with many varying factors at play. But there are some things that seem to unite many charities in 2025. One of those unifying factors is financial pressure. In recent years, economic factors have made it harder for charities to deliver their services. This means that those who usually benefit from charity services have lost out. Not only does financial pressure threaten the existence of many charity services, it can also mean that charities lack opportunities to innovate and improve their services to achieve their missions, ensuring that service users stay at the centre. In this podcast, I'm speaking to Joanne Mark-Jones and Laura Stanley to explore how charities are making the best of the current service delivery landscape, improving services with digital and engaging with service users in new ways. So first, as an overview, what is the environment for service delivery like in 2025?
A few months ago, we were sort of talking about cautious optimism, and I think people should still be cautious and less optimistic now. So basically, I think the economy, with Keir Starmer coming into power, there was a level of sort of stability, which we saw after what was essentially a lot of tumultuous years. And the stability, often it's almost like the absence of the bad equals good, because obviously since 2008 you had the financial crash, and then following years of austerity, and then you had the health crisis or the pandemic, and then you had the cost of living crisis. All of these, it felt like permanent crisis for a lot of charities, and they were constantly struggling against that, you know, because obviously with austerity they had to pick up the sort of gulf left by the lack of public funding and so on and so forth. And Brexit created some problems too, with the loss of funding from EU funds and so on and so forth. So it just felt like a lot of perma crises throughout the charity sector. And I guess the cautious optimism with the recent election was that maybe not just the election, it wasn't political or solely political, but it felt that the economy had kind of, it was coming back to some sort of stability post all these things. And it showed with some projections that suggested the UK economy would grow, albeit very sort of modestly. But that modest kind of growth and that stability, I do think affords charities this kind of ability to make decisions with a bit more clarity, and also the space maybe where they're not constantly firefighting, constantly trying to meet these demands from these events per se or whatever. I think it was looking good, and I think in recent months it's probably been less. The optimism has, we probably less reason to feel optimistic. And in the last couple of weeks, I think Donald Trump had a lot of threats in his campaigning, particularly around tariffs, which has obviously huge effects on the international and sort of global economy. And I think we're seeing those come to fruition maybe quicker than we imagined. And there's kind of hostile markets right now. And all of this means that charities are again feeling a little bit precarious. But I think overall the economic outlook still looks, I wouldn't say good, but certainly not terrible. And I think it gives you that freedom to make effective decisions and frees you up to think about how to improve your service delivery.
Yeah, I think we've seen that charities are really adaptive in the last few years, and hopefully there's a bit of confidence in the charity sector that they can weather those sort of storms.
Yeah.
I think what's interesting from a sort of digital service delivery perspective is that I think we're waiting for the next big thing at the moment.
Mm.
It seems to be a bit of a gap between what's going to influence services. And I think, for example, we've talked about how COVID-19 sort of accelerated digital transformation within charities, people having to move services online immediately to react to that. I think now we're not so much reactive as I think we can be a bit more proactive. We're not sure what the next big thing is. It could be AI, but it might not be. It's still sort of up in the air. So I think this is a really good time for charities to get the basics of their service delivery down. And that means going back to their mission and understanding what exactly they are exist to do, and how they're serving their service users, and that means user research. And this is a really good time to just consolidate all that and actually strategize, because we talk about this all the time in our content, but without strategy, like the tools, if AI is that big thing, we can't use that unless it has to be used in alignment with our goals. Yeah. And so I think this is the time to sort of sort that out. I think people thought 2022 would be that year, and then the cost of living crisis came, yeah. and then everyone was like, oh no, right.
I think we said it, didn't we?
Yeah, I think it was one of the themes of our conference.
I think I said cautiously optimistic.
Yeah, I think the conference was people were saying like, oh, okay, we've reacted to the pandemic now. And then literally in January, the cost of living crisis came.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh no, we've got to do more with less again. And I think that's still the case. And I think that will always be the case in the charity sector to an extent.
Yeah.
But I agree with you. I think there's reason for cautious optimism in terms of stability. Mm. And stability means consolidation.
Yeah. And I said certainly pick up on the... Because, of course, it was a global... Well, not just global, but global affairs basically dictated the cost of living in so many ways, you know, whether it was kind of like a hangover from Brexit, but obviously the invasion of the Ukraine was a primary force in inflationary economics across the world. I think the other thing to say is that Laura picked up on the fact that charities are always kind of doing more with less, and that's true, but... I think over the last 15 years, 16 years, they've been doing a lot more with a lot less. And the problem right now is that there's still such high demand for services. Mm-hmm. So charities still have that little bit of fire, well, not little bit, quite a lot of firefighting to do in terms of just trying to meet that service user demand. Mm-hmm. So that will obviously take a lot of work and will hopefully suggest some ways to address that. But I think the stability at least gives you a bit more freedom to address it rather than this constant feeling of like being overwhelmed, essentially.
Yeah, so I think that paints a really clear picture of the how funding constraints are still shaping service delivery. And something else I wanted to add was about how the government is raising employer national insurance contributions from April and how charities are expecting that to cause a lot of financial pressure. And charities are already expecting this to impact service users. I think, yeah, it's just bringing into context the how challenges of charities are impacting the service users at the end of the day. And I think, yeah, anyone listening who works in charity can recognise a lot of the things we just talked about. So building on that, how are charities making the best of the current service delivery landscape?
I think it sort of goes back to what I was saying in the first question, maybe. But I think I think they're doing it through strategising and collaboration, basically. So literally two of the things that I brought up. Because I think for strategy, I think the charities that are doing the best are the ones that are looking to their service users for what they actually need, because that might have changed over time. I'm thinking specifically of this is about more of a fundraising angle, but we interviewed someone who is the head of Gaming for Good in their charity, and they were saying that they had all these resources ready for the gamers and the streamers so they could join their fundraising, but that wasn't what they needed. They needed fundraising. They didn't need advice on gaming, they needed advice on fundraising specifically. And I think that applies to service delivery, and what you think people need isn't necessarily what people need, especially in circumstances that are evolving, such as the cost of living crisis. And I think generally, this is what I was saying in the first thing, I think it's a really good time to go back and just check. We want to steer away from telling service users what they need and actually giving them what they need, right? And so I think user research is a really good way. Make yourself more efficient, because it means you're actually directly helping the problem. And also, ensuring that your services are fit for purpose. I also think, collaboration, I think, is really important in the charity sector. I think we learn from each other a lot. The pandemic, again, not to go back to it, but it showed that. I think we were all learning on the job. And I think, especially when it comes to digital technology, AI is another really good example. We had the AI summit last November?
Yeah.
October. The people were sharing resources all day. It was such a great day to hear what people were doing. And AI is quite scary, I think, because there are lots of risks, there are lots of opportunities, but I think it's an unknown territory, and we still really don't know what it'll do. Like, we keep getting told, like, it'll summarise emails, and it'll, write you a bit of text, but we still sort of don't know what impact it's going to have on service delivery. And I think there are a lot of charities that are sharing that information, and that's a really good way to learn quite quickly. So I think, and also, it's that takes time and resource, but it doesn't take loads of money. Yeah. I think that's it's a really nice, I don't know, I just think that's a really good way of charities to find out common ground, to tackle common problems, basically, and make sure they're using their tools effectively.
Yeah, I think the AI point's really interesting, because one of my suggestions would be for charities to embrace, well, the charities that are embracing emerging tech is obviously a really huge opportunity, like Laura said, but I would caveat it with saying don't just presume, because everyone else is talking about a certain form of tech, that that's the tech for you. So AI is the obvious example. AI does offer huge opportunities. It can be used in really interesting ways. We haven't really seen the productivity boom that everyone was projecting, so that hasn't happened. And it's largely because the use cases that we've seen so far have been relatively minimal. Yeah. A lot of people claim to be using it for all these things. Most people use it for research. They use it as a basic expedited version of Google search, right? So that's kind of where it's come down to. And 2025 will be the year that AI moves beyond its hype and becomes more practical. And charity should totally look at that as one potential, if it aligns with what you want to achieve. But I would say always make sure the tech is suited to what you're doing. Don't suit your service users' needs, like Laura said, should come first. And then think about what tech might help you achieve that, not the other way around. So don't use AI for the sake of AI because it's just a pointless thing to do. And a lot of people are doing that. We're watching it happen where people across the economy are onboarding AI without much idea of how to use it. And they're not getting the productivity booms they've been promised because they're not using it in any productive way. So I'd definitely recommend caution around that. And in terms of actual emerging tech, there's loads of examples of charities doing incredible things from recent years. So the NSPCC used virtual reality to raise awareness of child abuse. The Talk to Me campaign was a result of a partnership with a gamification training provider called Atensi, I believe. So that was an immersive simulation that aims to build confidence in young adults and adults working with children to talk about challenging issues. Acorns Children's Hospice had a VR tour of its facilities that helped children kind of ease into their hospice and ease their minds. So it basically involved a guided tour of their facilities to make them see that it could be a really nice place to be. And then the last one I'll mention is a kind of emerging tech from a couple of years ago that never fully emerged, or certainly didn't take on the sort of same sort of, I guess, didn't have the same impact in the way we talk, and so certainly wasn't a talking point in the same way. But blockchain, the World Food Programme has a use of blockchain, and their Building Blocks initiatives has basically looked at the largest humanitarian use of blockchain technology and allowing organizations to work together, coordinate efforts, and basically stretch their resources. What it does is it's an interesting way, and it ties back into what Laura said about collaboration. It allows charities to, so much of collaboration, one of the joys of it is that it undermines the duplication of work. Mm-hmm. Charities duplicate work, they always have duplicated work, but if you can make sure that your work is the most effective by working with other charities, maybe you can go further. And blockchain is this really transparent tech that allows you to basically track everything you're doing. So from the same account, people can donate a variety of items from hundreds of different charities, and they can make sure that it's only going to the right people who need those resources. So the point is, those are just some examples, but my main point is just to think about service users' needs. That's the first thing, and then to see what tech might help you achieve that, and that's a recipe, I think, for success. Oh, well, that was weird. Sorry, I don't know where that came from.
Also, add about data that I think looking.
We're actually running out of time.
There's always time for data. I think data is a really important tool for charities in making the best and making themselves more efficient and effective, because it can tell you quite a lot about whether your services are working, where you need to perhaps focus more effort. I think the 2024 Charity Digital Skills Report revealed that a third of charities aren't using data to inform decision making, or are poor at, which is neither of which is ideal. And I think it can really shape the future direction of your charity if it shows friction areas where perhaps there's not enough services in this local area. Or I think some people are using it with predictive tools to find out areas that might become affected. I'm sure there were charities in the cost of living crisis finding out where people would likely to need their services. Yeah, so I think basically make the most of data as well, and I should have said that first. Yeah. Because I think it's a really important point, and it sounds, everyone switches off when they hear the word data, but I think it's really important.
I think it's one of those things that as well can help reduce the amount of money that needs to be spent on things. Mm. And so it seems boring, but it actually helps a lot.
With AI as well, data is obviously going to become more, having clean and, you know, trustworthy data is obviously going to be super important. Just to pick up on Laura's point, with Great Ormond Street Hospital used AI to improve care by finding patterns and insight in their data. And Parkinson's did something interesting using AI with the data available to track topics and themes that were discussed online, and they uncovered the things that people wanted them to do and develop services based on that information. So that's a really good way of using data available to provide a service that people want by basically finding out what they want by all the available data you have. And that's where AI can be super helpful, actually. I think data analysis is where people are sort of talk about but don't actually use, and what they actually do instead is just, you know, write a poem of seven lines about, you know, something. Anyway, but Parkinson's UK basically created a keeping fit. Keeping fit, they noticed, was a core concern, and they launched a fitness channel on their YouTube. So that was a good, that was such a good way of seeing, all right, what do our audience want? Collecting it, streamlining that with emerging tech, and then producing an outcome that is effective. So again, it kind of combines everything we're saying. Think about your service users' need. Make sure the emerging tech you use is actually applicable to that need, and then use the data to drive that decision. And so they did. Well done, Parkinson's UK, and I mean, loads of other charities done great things, but not just Parkinson's UK.
I also think there's something about how you use digital technology has an impact on the service users themselves. So if there's a way to co-produce services with service users and have them involved in how you use things like AI and or anything like VR or data, I guess it's looking at what the priorities of the people who you're working for, what their priorities are, and delivering services in the way that suits them. Also, another point from the Charity Digital Skills Report is that digital tools are interwoven into service delivery a lot more. So 81% of charities are using digital technology in some capacity in their services, and the three most common ways of using digital are so behind the scenes, so for example, project management, organisation and online registration, 62% do this. Almost as many, so 57%, are using digital tools to form part of service delivery or to complement core services. So things like video calling or hosting an online community. And 29% are using digital tools in service delivery minimally because they're prioritising face-to-face delivery. I think that's an interesting point as well about face-to-face delivery and how do you balance digital with face-to-face, especially in the context of digital exclusion, where a lot of service users or supporters or anyone, volunteers, might not have access to your charity because it's only online. So I think that's a big part of it as well. And only 5% of charities are operating solely online now. And also about the artificial intelligence part of it, I think there's a lot of interest about that, but that doesn't necessarily mean that most charities are actually using it for service delivery, because I think a lot of charities do understand that there are risks. And the skills report said that 65% of charities think AI developments are relevant to them, but only 15% are using AI tools in their service delivery. So I think that shows a healthy skepticism about AI, especially when it comes to obviously the end users of a service.
Yeah, and to that point, I would just like to sort of add, and I think charities obviously know this because of that, but cyber security and data breaches are a really big concern for the, I think Charities Aid Foundation did a big review into public concerns around AI and whether about charities specifically using it, and cyber breaches and data breaches were really high up on those concerns. And I think particularly when it comes to service users, that's a real caution. I mean, it's an obligation legally, but it's also if you don't know the tool that you're using is secure, then you've got to be really careful, basically. And again, we don't know how a lot of these tools work yet.
Definitely.
What you're using them in, obviously. Things like Copilot are within the scope, I think, of the security that you've got. Microsoft.
Yeah, but I mean, I don't think people are, I think ChatGPT is probably the most widely used, but also I think with the AI point, it was like, it is interesting because again, it's like the application of it with service delivery, we still have seen some examples, but it's minimal and hard to find.
It was actually a big question at the AI summit. Someone was like, can you give me a practical example of this in practice? And there were a couple, but there wasn't a lot, and it wasn't something that was applicable across charities, directly applicable to the charity that answered the question, but it wasn't necessarily the answer.
And the examples we've given so far with Gosh and then Parkinson's UK and some other examples I have here, like for example the Joe Cox Foundation used a 24/7 chatbot called a loneliness advice chatbot on WhatsApp. Mencap had the Understand Me chatbot, which we referenced years ago. There's an AI tool called Intention Insight that looks at your website and kind of scopes out how effective it is for service users. None of these things were impossible a few years ago. They might not have been as sophisticated, but they weren't impossible. So it's like, I guess it's about trying to balance this like sort of brave new world approach where everyone's sort of saying this is the future, this is everything it's going to take. And we've seen agentic AI in the last few days or demonstrations, and it looks impressive, it sounds impressive, and everything about it talk around it is revolutionary, or it's constantly apparently going to revolutionize everything. But it's also like we're not seeing huge examples, and I think that's where our caution comes from when we're sort of saying make sure that you consider all emerging tech, because what we don't want to see is a charity sector so indebted to AI because everyone's saying you should be, that they forget all these other incredible tools that are coming out or are here that you could definitely, because the VR stuff, for example, VR is not a tool that is being, in fact, it's a tool that's seen in the wider economy is kind of a bit of a failure almost. You know, we saw, you know, a lot of apparently great things were going to happen 5 years ago, and they didn't really take off in the same way, apart from like bars you can go to now where you sort of climb a mountain or something. But the point I'm making is that emerging tech has actually had quite a few applications for charities in terms of service delivery, because service delivery, its final point, is it's usually quite specific and it's specific to charities, and AI is quite broad, but it's not the solution to everything. It probably can be helpful to you, but always think about application in terms of emerging tech is just the final point.
I think what's interesting is that AI, as we think about it in terms of the way it's been revolutionised since 2022 and ChatGPT emerging and whatnot, is generative. Mm. And there's less applications in service delivery for generative AI than there is for predictive AI, which is the using your data to predict where all these...
Or extractive, which is what Parkinson's were doing. Yeah.
Yeah, right. But those tools have existed for ages.
Yeah. They're more sophisticated now, but yeah.
Yeah. So
just bigger data sets, really.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I think... So... I don't know what my point was.
No, I think your point is really important, though. It's that generative AI is what the hype is. We're not hyping on about extractive AI. Not really. People might, but the point is that generative AI is the thing. And to be honest, for me, it's the showstopper because it does those cool things. Mm. And there's no doubt there's cool. It's cool. Like, do an explosion with someone walking backwards. That's cool. But at the same time, it's not going to serve people their food. You know, and I think that's where my caution lies, because I've been in rooms with people who have shown me AI and they've been like, look at this, I did this in 10 minutes, and it's a picture of someone like sort of like walking away from an explosion. I kind of go, cool man, like, but what's that gonna do for the world, exactly. You know, I guess that my reservation was always AI's great, it's got huge amounts of power, but always think about how your application, sorry, I just repeated myself, stole your thunder.
No, that's exactly it. And I think it should always just come back to what we said at the start, which is align it with your mission goals, and then you'll find the tool that you need. What's the problem I'm trying to solve? How can I do it?
Yeah, and I think that also comes back to the idea of partnerships and collaboration. And even though a lot of charities all do very unique things, or every charity does something unique, but there must be overlap between different charities, and how can charities develop? If a certain charity is using AI to deliver services, then how can they help other charities with that?
Yeah.
So that the work isn't duplicated. Mm. There's another point about how AI, the way it's being driven in a lot of organisations, is from the bottom and not from the top, which is probably why it's not being used for service delivery very much.
It does feel like people are using it like at their desks.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's more of an individual basis rather than organisational, isn't it? I'm sure I read somewhere that
Zoe Marr.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But not just that. Today it was in the BBC. It was reports saying that 50% of people, that might not be exactly right because it's top of my head, but 50% of people, I think it was right, 50% of people in the knowledge sector, that's people who work at desks essentially, use AI or behind their bosses' back in some forms if they don't use it. And it's not that they're doing it maliciously. Their bosses don't, some bosses don't mind, some bosses do mind. Like people have, I know plenty of people who have do not use AI policies because they're afraid of the risk, which are real and completely undervalued in the wider society, I think. But a lot of companies do, and some companies, you need risk appetite, right? So some companies can afford to take that risk. A lot of people dealing with subjects that may be more difficult to talk about, and when you're dealing with service user data and all these things, that risk is, your risk appetite is far reduced because you can't afford to let those people down, breach trust, reputational damage and so on. So you should have a low risk appetite. But for other companies, if you're not doing anything like that, you can have a higher risk appetite, right? Like that, I don't know, I keep saying risk appetites.
I've never heard that phrase before.
That makes sense, yeah.
Yeah, anyway, but my point was rather that, like, if you're sitting at a desk, I think a lot of people actually, mm-hmm. the use of AI, yeah. is a lot more people just kind of sitting at their desk. I don't know if that was kind of your point.
Yeah.
I just stole again.
No. I think the part that worries me is about people who might be using AI in a way that isn't like part of a strategy or agreed, and it could be impacting on people, but there's no kind of research or that or
paper trail even.
Yeah, like people who could be using AI just to make their work, like reduce their workload or something, or benefit from any of the benefits it has, but because it's happening on a personal basis and also without necessarily any kind of team agreement or like risk exploration or anything like that, that could lead to risks.
Yeah, because, well, like Laura said earlier, if you put your service users into an AI that then exists in that AI, or some of them, it depends on the model, but you might be jeopardizing the private information and by doing so, and no one would know it was you.
No.
Which means that opens it up for more risk, because if no one's going to know it's you, well,
AI can't unlearn stuff. So
no.
If you put it in a tool that is training off your data, then it's but this is why an AI policy is really, really important, and probably it's something you should think about even when you're at the experimental stage of it. Like, what are your parameters for that? Who can do it? How will you use data in conjunction with that? Like, anonymize it.
Yeah. And you can use that any time. On almost all models have anonymous options, or all good models will have one. So use it, you know?
And again, like, look at the security parameters a bit. Like, I don't think Copilot... We do have a guide to Copilot, so check that, but don't take me. But I'm pretty sure it doesn't train on your data, and it keeps it within the boundary of what your Microsoft security already is. So, like, if you're going to try it, if you want to experiment with a tool, maybe do something if they've got one in-house.
Yeah.
Or rather than going to, like, ChatGPT on the web, you know what I mean? Basically, I've made this into an AI problem. I just think... it's just coming back to policies again, like... Policies are really important, and I think now's the time to get some. I would just like to add on the change of approach that I hope we see more co-production, as Josie was talking about, and reliance on beneficiary feedback mechanisms, because too few charities have those, I think. They sound really fancy, but actually it could just be a survey or a hotline or a way of your service user getting in touch and talking about the services they received or what they need. And I just think if we see more reliance on that, I think that will change the approach of many charities going forward.
Totally.
Yeah. That also links back into AI and how obviously AI can be quite an easy way to get answers, and I think that's the wrong impulse. Personally, I think that's wrong, because actually it should be the service users who drive what tell you what's needed, tell you what who they are, what they need, what their priorities are, and how successful your services are, whether they're working and all of that. And you can't use AI for a lot of that.
It's like, this is so trite what I'm about to say, but charities are sort of in the business of human connection, right? And so, like, AI is great, but it can't actually replace what charities exist for, which is to help the communities they serve.
Mm. Yeah.
So it requires looking to those communities.
I guess the problem charities might feel in response to that is that it takes a lot more time.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
actually it could lead to a much better, higher quality service.
And time saving.
Yeah, time saving in yeah. the end.
The BFMs. I think two things, one, digital inclusion within that. So obviously one thing we do at Jarrett, we actually do quite a lot of surveys. We actually reach out to our users, the people who read our websites.
We have
committees. So we do it. We just don't call it BFMs. Yeah. But one thing about our surveys is we started doing it and realized how actually super simple it is. Mm. So you put together a survey on Microsoft Forms, Google Forms, they're two free options if you have those. But Google Forms will be free, I'm sure. I think SurveyMonkey is free to a certain degree.
Yeah.
And there's probably 50 other options that are free anyway. They take 2 minutes, you get a link and you send them out. That's vital. It gets you great feedback, can really hone your services to meet service user needs. And then on top of that, you do have to have some caution around digital inclusion. So some people won't have access to the internet or won't have access to those links or won't be proficient at using it and stuff like that. So then just always give those options or try and find those options where you could maybe call someone, or apparently, according to research, the absolute best is face-to-face, but it's not always available to everyone. But yeah, so they're quite simple ways to do it, and actually not the most time consuming, and probably like Josie said, save you time in the future. So yeah. It's a really long-term vision, but something you should definitely make part of your everyday working life if you work in service delivery, I think. And one other point on the reference to collaboration and cooperation is that last year we had a digital inclusion campaign which we felt went really well. But what we saw in the sector, not ourselves, but some other people leading in that way, the National Digital Inclusion Network led by Good Things Foundation and loads of different charities being involved in that and working with them. And we saw in real time the advantage of actual collaboration around service delivery, and so many people learning and knowledge sharing and advocacy work and everything like that. So we got to witness it, and there's loads of other examples like the Climate Crisis Coalition. They do a great thing by boosting advocacy. One of the benefits of collaboration is that you have a more common and united front, I think, and it with an issue like climate change, for example, which can often be attacked in so many different ways by so many different people. Some see it as slow violence, other like it needs action today and so on and so forth, like it's the world's burning. And obviously there's so many different approaches, and having a more unified voice and an understanding and a common consensus, I think, allows you to have a much stronger approach to it. So yeah, I mean the virtues of collaboration are so wide and they're so good, and certainly something that I hope people take up more in 2025.
So before we wrap up, I wanted to introduce our campaign for the coming year. It's called the Reimagining Services Campaign. So in this campaign, we will be covering how charities can deliver the best services possible with the resources they have. We have decided to launch this campaign to make some space to focus on charity services themselves. It's a pivotal, complex and under pressure part of charity work, yet we have noticed that it isn't always held in the centre of conversations compared to other areas of charity operations. Some of the themes of the campaign will be how to improve charity services with digital, how to make sure service users are in the centre of service delivery, and how to make resources go further in service delivery. So I just wanted to discuss some of our hopes for the campaign as a team and some of the things we still think there are left to learn this year.
I think my hope, generally even just engaging for the first month or so on the campaign, I found that there's a lot that I didn't know or take into consideration. So service delivery, like Josie said, it can be one of those things that we oddly don't talk about so much when it's the cornerstone. We talk about fundraising a lot, but we don't talk about service delivery enough. So the first obvious hope is that we start talking about it a lot more. The second hope, though, is something that I've seen, and like I was talking about, when I've done preliminary research, there's finding these new ways of engaging with service users. It's stuff that I didn't even know myself because there was such a gap of knowledge there. And I'm excited to see what else comes out of it and what else I start to learn. So particularly around, like reimagining services, better ways of doing services, undermining sort of deficit narratives and paternalism and all these other things that I see so often with charity campaigns, always saw as a bit of an issue, but never really understood what the issue was in as much detail. So learning from my perspective has been already really interesting. And I know we're leading, but and that's the point, is that we can learn hopefully and then share our knowledge with other people. But so far I'm just enjoying the amount that I'm learning, and it sort of speaks to the fact that it's an under talked about part of our sector. But yeah, that's I'm looking forward to learning.
I agree with that. I'm really looking forward to hearing more about how the charity sector is innovating, because I think there's a lot of innovation that goes on behind the scenes that we're not particularly good at sharing our wins.
Yeah.
And every time Charity Digital has an event, I feel like I'm sat in the audience agape because I can't believe that that's going on. Like, it's so interesting hearing from people directly about the work they're doing. And I think Johan's right that it's an under talked about area, I think, and I just I'm looking forward to hearing more about the different ways that charities are innovating, and I'm also looking forward to the fact that I think we're going to share a bit more about that. And I think if we can start encouraging more, it's bringing all that information together and having our reimagining services hub as a place where people can find out what other charities are getting up to, because I think inspiration is going to be a really big part of the next step, the future direction of charities, basically.
Yeah, I think that was part of the idea behind the name as well, with reimagining, is kind of about all the different many ways services could be delivered to be as good as they could be. So that's one of my hopes, is like, one thing I'm looking forward to is to explore all the different perspectives that different people have, and or different charities have many different ways of different types of services and different approaches to services. So obviously everyone will come with a different perspective. So I think that'll be really interesting. I'm hoping as well the campaign will help charities deal with the difficulties of the service delivery landscape. Mm-hmm. Hopefully by hearing from each other and seeing what other charities are doing, and also ultimately at the end of the day help the end users of charity services, who we don't see all the time as our team, because we're talking just to the charities. Yes. But that's our hope, is to improve things for them as well. But equally, we know there's currently a knowledge gap when it comes to service delivery in 2025. So we've launched a survey, which is a chance for our readers and listeners to have their voice heard on what service delivery looks like in 2025. So that will include to what extent charities are able to deliver the services that their users need, how charities are incorporating AI into service delivery, and how many charities use co-production to design and deliver their services. And we will link the survey in the podcast description, and we're really looking forward to seeing all the results. Yeah, so I think that's all we have time for. Thank you for this conversation.
Thank you. We hope you enjoyed this Charity Digital podcast. The views, thoughts, and opinions expressed are those of the speakers and do not represent the views, thoughts, and opinions of Charity Digital. The material and information presented here is for general information purposes only. Thanks for listening.